Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to explore the boundaries of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Jenny Peruski from Harvard University. Today, I'm here to talk to Peter Gordon and Juan Jose Morales, the authors of Painter and Patron, The Maritime Silk Road in the Codice Casanatense, published by the Abbreviated Press in 2020. Peter Gordon is editor of the Asian Review of Books and publisher of Chameleon Press. He was also a founder of the Man Asian Hong Kong International Literary Festival. Juan Jose Morales is an entrepreneur and historian who has published a variety of works ranging from poetry anthologies to works on arts and culture. Their publication, Painter and Patron, takes an in-depth look at an illustrated manuscript known as the Codice Casanatense, which was produced in the 16th century in Goa and contains 76 watercolors. Morales and Gordon's study details the cultural context in which this object was produced, emphasizing the intense global connections taking root in Goa at this time. Turning now to our speakers, Peter and Juan, I'd like to welcome you to New Books in the Indian Ocean World. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about your book today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jenny.
Can you maybe each start us off by saying a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, or if you had any particularly influential mentors on your path?
I was born in Madrid, Spain, and I love history since I was a child. My father was also a keen historian, aficionado historian, and we have many books of history. Even from early age, I start to read serious books on history. For example, the accounts of the Spaniards in America, like Cabeza de Vaca, Toribio de Motolinía, or Bernal Díaz del Castillo. And in the end, I studied law in Complutense University. It was the old University of Alcalá. And it's a 13th century university. But I continue to study history in another institution of high learning called La Rábida, led by some of the most important historians in Spain, Vicente Rodríguez Casado, Luis Suárez Fernández, or Francisco Morales Padrón. And so we have meetings and seminars of over a week that took place in heritage places like palaces, castles, monasteries. And really, it was a privilege for me to be in contact with these professors. But it was not until 25 years ago, 1995, 1996, when I came to Hong Kong, that I start to know about the history of the Iberians in Asia, with the age of exploration and navigation spearheaded by the Portuguese and the Spanish, and their presence in Asia. And it was actually in English that I start to read about this experience, thanks to friends that I met here, art historian Cesar Guillén Núñez. Actually, he comes from the University of Pennsylvania, where he was also a professor. And Jonathan Wattis, who is a very reputable dealer in maps, or antique maps of East Asia. I was a map collector myself. And I realized in the maps of the 15th, of the 16th and early 17th century, so most of the names were in Spanish. And there were, although many of those maps were printed in Amsterdam, perhaps, there have so many Spanish names and Portuguese names. And then they introduced me to a great historian called British historian Charles Boxer, or C.R. Boxer. And he was the great historian of the Portuguese in Asia. Although the first book that I was given was South China in the 16th century, with accounts of Mendoza, one of the most important accounts of China, written by the Spaniard Juan González de Mendoza. C.R. Boxer is for me a mentor. He passed away, but he was also a very colorful figure. He was an officer of the British Army. He was a spy for the British. He was a prisoner in a concentration camp of the Japanese in Hong Kong. He had also a very famous love affair with Emily Han, the famous writer. And well, he finally became a professor in London University of Portuguese Studies. And not only he was a great scholar, a great researcher, but he wrote beautifully, eloquently, and he has a very good judgment. Later on, I will tell more anecdotes about C.R. Boxer because it will be relevant to our talk.
My background is completely different. I'm from Massachusetts and went to Harvard, as a matter of fact, and I actually did mathematics and linguistics. And I ended up in tech for a good 30-odd years, but there was always a cultural element to it because a lot of the work was making computers work in languages like Arabic and Thai. And from all of that, I moved into setting up an e-commerce firm in Hong Kong, which had to do with books. That led to setting up the Asian Review of Books, which is as its name implies, a book review publication. And that led into some of these other activities where I met Juan. And as you mentioned, we've done a few volumes of poetry together and then moved into some of these other projects.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about your very diverse backgrounds, especially working in relation to literature and language development. I think maybe moving into your book, my understanding, and you've explained a little bit of this as well, is that you've worked together previously on poetry anthologies, as well as co-authoring the book, The Silver Way, China, Spanish mm-hmm. America, and the Birth of Globalization, 1565 to 1815. Can you tell us a little bit about your history of working together and how the idea for painter and patron developed?
Sure. Juan and I have known each other for quite a few years now. And we first started doing cultural things together. Hong Kong's a kind of an interesting place. It's a big city, but in some ways it's really very small. And so it's possible to do things here that might be difficult in a much larger place. So we did a few volumes of poetry with Asian poets based upon Cervantes and Octavio Paz. And then Juan also reviewed for me at the Asian Review of Books. And as he said, he focused on books about the early European presence in Asia. And in particular, there were a few books about the Manila Galleon. And the Manila Galleon was this annual trading ship that went between Manila and Acapulco every year for 250 years. And as he was reviewing some of these, this was when President Xi Jinping announced what was then called the New Silk Road, And one morning I realized that the Manila Galleon wasn't the Silk Road, but a Silver Road going in the other direction. So I very quickly wrote off a paper about this, again, related to the present day. And then Juan and I, when we needed to turn it into a history, did this small book for Penguin. So that was the first book. This book started because the actual album, the Codice Casanatense, sits in a library in Rome. It's been there since 1700. And the Italian diplomatic missions here were interested in trying to bring the document out to Asia to show it, where it's really very little known, if known at all. And so this book was conceived as a first step in making the work better known here. And, you know, if you look at the watercolors themselves, they're really very nice. They're very appealing. They're very human. They're not at all formal. The figures themselves are often smiling. They have a twinkle in their eye. And when there's a couple, a man and woman together, which is one of the most common formats, the man and the woman look at each other, which looks like real affection. They look like real people. But this sort of aesthetic appeal aside, the geographical spread of the painting, something we'll talk about, pretty much maps onto what we now call the Maritime Silk Road, which is a term that appears all the time in newspapers out here. So that was really our hook for an Asian-based treatment of this document.
And what was the research and writing process for this book, particularly working together on it? How did you decide who would write which parts?
Well, between us, as you may have noticed, Juan is the historian. And I do a lot of writing, particularly for the newspapers. And so that was really the division of labor. Another division is that Juan knows all the books, ancient and modern, that have been written on all these various subjects. And one of the things I'm good at, though, is finding things hidden in the corners of the internet. So if you like, that was really the division of labor. Juan would set general outlines of what the history was. I would try to fill in the blanks and connect the dots and do that sort of research and kind of construct the narrative. And then Juan would ensure that it was all historically proper.
Well, I may add that it has also a very entertaining part. So the great breakthroughs happen through lunches, coffees, or drinks. That is not only very entertaining, but very productive.
Yeah, this process of writing a book together has been, as Juan says, very productive. We don't agree about everything. And the need, most of what you might call the breakthroughs come from trying to reconciling these two different opinions about what we're looking at and what we think is going on. And so the need to find common ground is often where when we figure out what's really going on. So it's, I guess it's like being constant peer review all the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And how do you see this as developing on or departing from your previous work?
Well, it has many things to do because with the Silver Way, so the book about the Manila Galleon or the silver trade between Spanish America and China, that was the first chapter of the monetary history and the great chapter in the history of trade and globalization. And it has in common with the current book, Painter and Patron, about this codice in Goa, that is about the Iberian powers. So there are countries that they are neighbors and they have so much in common, but they have been living also back to back. And so we are talking about the same period in both books, 16th century. Two partners that they have many, many things in common, the Spanish and the Portuguese, and their histories have been interacting for millennia. And there are chapters very little known, So the silver trade is very important as the foundation of a global war, but it's very little known. Adam Smith wrote about it, but it has been forgotten, and particularly in the English-speaking world. In the same way, painter and patron about this college in Goa, the presence of the Portuguese in Asia, they were the first Western power to come to Asia and to stay. Also, it is completely unknown. This college has very little attention by the academia, but actually not really exploring or not getting to the heart of the matter or of the secrets that this college has, that I think they are important to share. So there are a lot of parallels, and some even sources could be similar as well.
Fascinating. Well, let's turn now to your book. Your text is divided into 5 chapters entitled Paper, Patron, People, Painter, and Postscript, each of which considers a different aspect of the illustrated manuscript, namely its production, who it was made for, who it was made by, and what is illustrated within. Together, these chapters offer an intimate look at daily life in Goa within various ethnic and socioeconomic groups. Beginning with your introduction, you offer the reader a broad overview of the Codice Cassina Tense manuscript, including a brief history of the time and place in which it was produced. Can you tell listeners how people were living and interacting in mid-16th century Goa?
Sure. Goa in the 16th century was the place to be. It was known as Goa Dourada, or Golden Goa. And there was a proverb at the time that went, he who's seen Goa need not see Lisbon. So it was a metropolis. It was a trading center, very, very cosmopolitan. A Dutchman who was an aide to the Portuguese archbishop in the 1580s, we'll come back to him, Jan Huygen van Lieshouten, wrote about it, and he describes the main market street as being a place where there were all kinds of spices and dried drugs, sweet gums and such things, fine and costly coverlets, and many curious things out of Gujarat, the Sindh, Bengal, and China. There were Indian merchants on another street that were selling all kinds of silks, satins, damasks, and curious works of porcelain from China and other places. So it was a place of trade. It was a place where people from all around the Indian Ocean came together and met. And it was under Portuguese rule at the time. So it was a mixing place of cultures and commerce and peoples.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
How would you say Portuguese intervention shaped these interactions?
Can you repeat the question?
Portuguese intervention was an important facet of interaction, as you discuss throughout your book. Can you tell us a little bit more about how Portuguese intervention, Portuguese I hesitate to say colonialism is shaping these interactions.
Yes. Well, we have when Vasco da Gama, one of the Portuguese explorers, first arrived in Calicut, in the southwestern coast of India. This was in 1498. It was a momentous event in the world's history. So here the Portuguese, the Europeans, came to stay. It is significant that when their first men of Vasco da Gama they landed in Calicut, they were confronted by two Arab traders who asked them in Spanish, ¿Qué demonios venís a hacer aquí? What the hell are you doing here? And the Portuguese replied also in Spanish, venimos por cristianos y por especias. Venimos por Dios y por especias. We come for Christians and for spices. This anecdote summarizes also what is a small world, that there are Portuguese arriving in India speaking to Arab traders and in Spanish. They speak of a small world, a world that was to become smaller. And this is the key point of the Portuguese presence in Asia. And this is a key point also in our codex, in the Codex Casanatense. And at the same time, these sentences, we come for God and for spices, it summarizes the motivations what these powers came, the Spanish and the Portuguese, for an apostolic seal, but also for trading to have the riches of Asia. Immediately after they disembarked in Calicut in 1598, in very few years, in a very short period, the Portuguese will take by force the ports of Hormuz, Malacca, and Goa. With these three key places, and later added by some other factories and ports, they were able to control the traffic in Hormuz, the trade between Europe and India, but also the trade of the spices. It was like gold, was of a high value commodity, and it was really the engine of the world. The value of these spices. This control was never fully effective. They tried to get a monopoly, the Portuguese, on this trade. This is the age of trade, as some historians has described this period, like Fernand Braudel. It was never fully effective, so they were not powerful enough. At the same time, the Portuguese are different from the Dutch and the English that will come later, because the Portuguese didn't take over the sources of production, so that the local communities have also their own motivation and could set up their own prices and in this trade. The things will change with the Dutch and the Portuguese that really took over the means and the sources of production, and for really devastating effect for the region. So this is the framework of Portuguese Asia, and that they call Estado da India, and with a viceroy in Goa, Goa becoming the capital of the Portuguese seaborne empire.
I'd add something, if I might. One of the subtleties here is that there was a great deal of trade and there was a great deal of trade and contacts between the various Asian places, of course, well before the Portuguese got there, and the Portuguese, to some extent, inserted themselves into these networks. The main source of revenue for Goa for many years was actually the horse trade. which involved not anything to do with Europe at all, but trading horses from Persia into the Indian subcontinent. So this was a trading relationship that existed that the Portuguese ended up taking over and controlling. And in fact, in the Codex, you'll see lots and lots of horses. This is what people in Goa did. They were horse experts.
Thank you for that context and the bigger picture in which trade and kind of Portuguese intervention are operating. And this becomes a really critical context for your second chapter, because you conclude your second chapter by arguing that the patron of the CODIS was likely a casado, or a former soldier married to an indigenous woman in Goa, and someone who is affluent and well-connected. Can you elaborate on the social standing of the casado class and why you are attributing this CODIS to a member of it?
Yes, I will say that better why we discard other somehow potential patrons. For example, it has been suggested that the codice was the patron was a governor, a Portuguese governor of Goa, but the codex, we don't know exactly the author, so it would be very strange that a public figure doesn't leave a testimony of such an important work, because it was important in the sense that it has been preserved. So it couldn't be a public figure, because it lacks, this is a private document, and also the content reveals private intentions, so not something for the private domain. Nothing. It doesn't have an official stamp. It couldn't be a governor. It has been suggested also that it could be the patron could be García de Horta, one of the most remarkable figures in Asia in the 16th century, and perhaps in the world at that time. He was a botanist, and he wrote one of the most important books, a foundational book of the of botanics of India, and that is still relevant today. He was descendant of Spanish Jews, but he was born in the family forcibly converted, and he was born in Portugal, but he went to study in Spain in the universities of Salamanca and Alcalá, at that time at the heights of their prestige. He studied medicine and arts and philosophy. But García de Horta was really an intellectual, if we can say an intellectual at the time, a scientist, if we can say a scientist of the time. So interested in recording, cataloging, describing, classifying, even, for example, the interviews that he has with other people who could provide information on these plants. He distinctly record. Is very meticulous in his work. So for his temperament, he wouldn't have time for this kind of lighthearted codex of pictures of the scenes of the peoples of India and the Southeast Asia. So we could discard him as well. Some of the authors of some of the accounts that were actually not published at the time, like Castañeda or Duarte Barbosa or Tomé Pires, also they were not at the time that we believe that the codex was written, the codex was produced, that is around 1540 in Goa, could not be. The answer actually comes in the codex, and I will tell more the anecdote also how we came to this in our discussion, so how this could be or could not be. And because of the characteristics that we see in the codex, it's a private document, it's unknown, there is no trace of who could be, but it has been preserved. And I pass to and also in our communications by email or by WhatsApp, no? And not only about our lunches, coffees or drinks. I send the copies of a chapter of the book, The Portuguese Seaboard Empire by C.R. Boxer, that I mentioned at the beginning. The chapter, Soldiers, Settlers, and Vagabonds. And I told Peter, it must be one of these. And settlers, of course, means casados. Casado, married man, means, in our context, a former soldier married locally to a local lady, not only of India, but of the region, and who has become a settler, but mostly a settler in the context of Goa would mean mainly a trader, although they could also fill the ranks of the administration. So the casados were the backbone of Portuguese society. And this is also important when we interpret or we try to understand the presence of the Portuguese in Asia, is also the different interests and the different people. And the casados, for example, they could serve in the official carreiras or official tradings with the carracks or naos, the ships, official ships, crown sponsor ships, that they were serving some trading routes. Yes, they could serve this trade as well, but mostly, mainly, they were also private traders. And as such, they would have interests sometimes not in common with the crown. For example, maybe the governor or the crown itself, they would have, they would resort to violence. For example, when it started the trading season, because it was mainly a maritime trade, that maybe they will resort to blockade some ports or policies of attrition of the local population. The casados will oppose this because it will affect the trade. So once we have this this reflection on the context, the answer was in the codex itself. So, and it was Peter who immediately replied to me with the pictures of the codex that he, again, was looking with intent. And where we see the pictures of a betrothal or marriage between a Portuguese soldier with a sword and a local woman. And we see that there is another picture with where we see the same personage in the retinue, a soldier in the retinue of a fidalgo or a governor in Goa. So these images, obviously, they were made with intent. So there is an attempt at portraiture. So is they really since portraits? Unlike some other pictures that look like generic people. So the answer was there. And then, in fact, the codex, half of it, is really made of couples. Couples that they are man and woman interacting with each other, pointing to each other, looking at each other fondly. So this, obviously, the marriage was central. So the casado was central. And these casados not only were the backbone of the society in the Estado da India, but they could be also very powerful and they could be very well connected, not only within Portuguese society, but across the ethnic divide with the local potentates or neighboring rulers. And they would have a great knowledge and interest in the region, that this is what is reflected in the codex, a great interest in what this was. So the couples, for example, appears the couples of Aceh, Bijar, China, the Abyssinians, the Santo Tomas Christians, the Arabs. So all this world that is the Portuguese world in or the Portuguese connections in Asia, in the Estado da India.
There's another hint in the codex. The men in these couples very often are carrying arms. And you can see a great deal of attention in the kinds of weapons. There are normal bows and recurve bows. There's a flintlock musket where the actual mechanism is shown in some detail. Somebody involved must have known about this. And it's the sort of thing that a former soldier would have known. So there are these hints in the codex about at least the background of somebody that was in charge of the project. And so all of this kind of matches with a former soldier who married a local woman.
Well, and I hear both of you, especially towards the end here, talking about the illustrations in the manuscript, which is a particular subject of chapter 3, where you analyze a number of the depictions. And why the artist or author would have thought to include them. What is the image that we get of cultural contact through these illustrations?
The illustrations can be divided into two main groups. One is scenes, you know, basically daily life, farmers, women collecting water, blacksmiths, money changers, goldsmiths, people in the bazaar. There are a few of women bathing. There's a curious illustration of a Portuguese group holding a dinner party in a pool in Hormuz. There are a few illustrations of religious ceremonies. There are four which have got Portuguese in them. There's a naval battle. There's a local ruler on an elephant. There's not a great deal of rhyme or reason to these. They seem to be just subjects that someone found interesting and illustrative. The second group, however, which are these couples, seems to be a definite project of trying to illustrate all the peoples where the Portuguese touched down in the broader Indian Ocean, the region covered by the Estado da India, which, as I say, in turn maps onto the Maritime Silk Road. The illustrations themselves show a combination of something resembling direct observation, that is, the pictures of the local professions are probably something the painter could have seen for himself, but others must have been done from descriptions that somebody, and we presume the patron, provided to him. And some of the descriptions seem to be quite accurate, but others are quite inaccurate. And one of the best and somewhat more fun example of this is the illustration of a Chinese couple. This was executed before the Portuguese had settled in Macau. And the Chinese look more like burghers than actual Chinese. And there was a firsthand account of Chinese made by Tome Pires, based upon Chinese in Malacca. And it went like this. The people of China are white as we are. They're rather like Germans. They wear well-made French shoes with square toes. The women look like Spanish women. They wear pleated skirts with waistbands and little loose housecoats longer than our country. And that's exactly what this couple looks like. So what it seems to have happened is that when the painter didn't know, and when whoever was advising him didn't know, he was passed a description from which to paint. There are other cases where it seems that nobody really knew and any information. So the women in the Southeast Asian couples are often kitted out in saris. So there are no sarongs or longis in these illustrations at all. There are other rather surprising little details, and one that jumped out to both Juan and me almost immediately is that the Southeast Asian men are carrying a kris, which is the archetypal Southeast Asian dagger. And you look at the hilt and pommel, and it's unmistakable what it is. And it's not an Indian weapon, but it seems clear that the painter must have seen one, because I don't think you could draw this from a description. And it turned out that the Portuguese were fascinated by the kris, and that they'd even sent some back to Portugal. So by looking at the paintings in the codex, you begin to get a feel of what the painter might have known and seen, what information he must have been provided by someone else, where that information came from, the routes it took, some of the objects that must have traveled back and forth between different parts of Asia and Africa.
Fascinating. And so because both the patron and the painter of this codice are unknown, at least in terms of their specific names, we're left to piece together who the painter was through contextual clues and who the patron was for that matter as well. And contextually, you've associated him with the Casado class. What is the milieu and cultural context in which the manuscript was illustrated? And what does this tell us about the painter?
Until we started digging, there was very little idea where the painter might have come from, either his artistic milieu or any other sort of milieu. And this bothered us because we looked at the paintings and they look familiar. They're the kinds of things that you feel you've seen before somewhere but can't quite place. You know, they look a bit like tourist art, which is still sold in India, but there's a lot more to it than that. And then we stumbled across a reproduction of a wall mural from a Jain temple in Tamil Nadu, which shows a potentate in a palanquin, you know, a sedan chair. And this very same composition appears in the codex. It's the same same kind of palanquin. The people in front and at the side are the same. The numbers of people are the same. And the only difference is that the rider is a Portuguese woman. So other than the fact that the rider is different, the compositions are almost identical. This particular composition appears in more than one place in that temple and appears in other temples, so it seems to be something of a template. So what seems to have happened is our painter took this template and repurposed it to show a Portuguese scene rather than an Indian one. Then we looked further and we could see similarities between the codex and Jain manuscripts of the period has to do with the way textiles are treated, the way the brushstrokes are laid down, that sort of thing. And the other thing that was bothering us as we looked through other examples of art from the period is that Indian art of the period didn't normally include many daily scenes. You know, you don't normally find paintings of farmers or people working, but one form does. And these are what are known as invitation scrolls, in which a town would invite Jain religious leaders to come pass some time in the town itself. And to do this, they would paint a picture of the town. They would describe the town in pictures. And in the bazaar in the town, it would be divided up into little boxes, and each one of which would have a depiction of a certain occupation, smiths, money changers, and people weighing things. And so the exact sort of same ideas and compositions that you find in the codex. So this gave us a pretty good idea of where the painter himself came from. The next discovery we made that was that the painter copied from European prints as well. There was an Austrian trader by the name of Balthasar Springer that was on the 1505 Portuguese expedition to India. And when he came back, he wrote a book called Die Meerfahrt, which was filled with illustrations. In fact, about half of it was illustrations. And one of these is an Indian warrior with a round shield and raised sword. And there's exactly the same composition in the codex. And there seems no doubt that the painter somehow saw a copy of the book. This particular illustration is one half of one of these couples. And this particular idea of a couple showing a people and their sort of typical clothing and aspect had begun to appear in Europe in travel books and illustrations. And although the parallels aren't quite as obvious as the previous one, it would seem plausible that the painter had seen perhaps one of these prints. There's some famous ones by an artist called Hans Burkmeier. So we get a pretty good idea of who the painter was and what sort of things he must have seen in order to produce the codex. Now, this illustration of the woman in the palanquin is pretty interesting because it found its way into one of the most famous European books of the age. So I'll let Juan talk a little bit about the Itinerario.
Yeah, and it is remarkable that the codex speak or tell us about confluences and exchanges, influences for example, and in the context of the paintings, not only of the different systems of representations of Indian paintings before the Mughals, and the inspiration from European prints of the time, but the goddess could influence one of the most important books of the times, and is Itinerario by Lins Chotten, and one Dutch who was an aide of the Bishop of Goa around the years 1580s. And obviously he had access to the codex, wherever it might be, probably in within clerical circles, because we know that the codex ended up in the College of the Jesuits in Goa, that was perhaps the first university founded by St. Francis Xavier. And the character of Lins Chotten is very interesting. He was highly educated, and he took a lot of information that was confidential about the Portuguese, and finally left Goa and went back to Amsterdam, somehow changed sides to the Protestant side in the newly emerging Dutch Republic, and not only copy the Portuguese maps, and the first really professional or accurate maps of Asia that were later to be reproduced many times in different sizes, in miniature sizes. So this book, Itinerario by Lins Chotten, would open Asia to the European imagination, because although the Portuguese had been already almost one century, the information they gathered, they never shared it, and they was never made public. And so we have evidence that Lins Chotten saw the codex, because there are at least three pictures that they are almost identical, so that Lins Chotten has almost reproduced these images from the codex. One is the palanquin that, as Peter has said, we saw earlier in Jain temples, then in the codex, and from the codex to Lins Chotten, also the image of a cavalier, a horseman, probably the governor, and also the war ships, and there are pictures that they are almost identical. And so it's quite remarkable also that until now, no one has pointed out to these influences. So I think this little book, that is perhaps we are going to write also a larger book with color pictures. But this is the first time in our book, Painter and Patron, where we point out these influences in both directions.
And you conclude your study with the statement, and rather than being a record of Asia filtered through a European pen, the Codex is largely the opposite, a European mental map of the world filtered through the eyes of an Indian painter. This is really an interesting turn of phrase, thinking about the visual depiction of mental perceptions. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on this and how your conclusions came to this.
Juan pointed out that this was really the first pictorial description or the first set of images that come from the European penetration into Asia. You know, there had been chronicles, there had been written accounts, but this is the first one that is done in pictures. But what's interesting is that the person doing the pictures is not European. The person doing the pictures comes from India. And where he's getting his information from, where he's getting his direction from, is partly from himself. We think you can see that he must have chosen some of these scenes himself, things that interested him. But he's also getting information from his patron, the things that interest his patron, the world is the world of the patron. That is this spread of these pictures from East Africa all the way to China is the world of the patron, not the world of the artist. And you also see the things that people didn't understand very well at the time that get recorded in inaccuracies in the artwork. And so you get this, as I say, picture of the world, which is filtered through the eyes and the paintbrush of an Asian rather than a European.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I think we've taken up a lot of your time this evening. So I'll end with asking about what you're working on now. Can you tell us about any current or future projects?
Well, I have really enjoyed talking about this because I'm very enthusiastic about it. And I appreciate really your questions going really to the real points. Here. Now I'm working in editing the proceedings of a symposium that took place in Beijing some time ago in the University of Foreign Languages in Beijing, and about Diego de Pantoja. Diego de Pantoja was a Spanish Jesuit that came together with Matteo Ricci to China, and they were the first Europeans to enter the Forbidden City. But strangely enough, there has been a lot noise about Matteo Ricci, but nobody knows Diego de Pantoja. And although Diego de Pantoja really engaged in into the Confucian, the scholars, the Chinese scholars, in his own, in their own terms, you know, in with their own philosophy, and the books he wrote, they were very, very important. So I am actually learning a lot about what has been discovered, and I am gladly surprised that in China there is now a lot of scholarship on this early presence of the Spanish and Portuguese in Asia.
One of the other things I do in Hong Kong is involve myself in the performing arts, opera and theater. I'm actually working on a small opera now, which pandemic allowing will be doing in November. But one of the marvelous thing about these books that Juan and I work on are the stories we turn up. There are all these really interesting people who've got marvelous and interesting lives. They're usually not the kings and queens or knights. They're merchants and soldiers. And we know just enough about them to begin to be able to construct stories about them and their lives. And I think these stories are really interesting, and they haven't really been written about very much as stories. And one of the advantages of doing this through the performing arts is you don't necessarily have to be historically accurate. But I think there's a lot of inspiration that can be found in all of these dusty corners of libraries. And that was why this was a really good project for me.
Thank you so much. It's so fascinating to hear about the projects you're currently working on and the interrelationships between history and current art projects. And so thank you both so much for your insights into painter and patron today. And I want to thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored the intercultural world of 16th century Goa through Peter Gordon and Juan José Morales' fascinating painter and patron, The Maritime Silk Road in the Codice Casanatense, published by the Abbreviated Press in 2020. This is your host, Jenny Peruski. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.